Is that too loud for it? Is that okay? Yeah? Okay. I'll just have to deal with the strange echo in my own mind, which I always have to deal with. Happy New Year, everyone. Let's get all those out of the way. I am here to talk about the novel in the city. Yes? You are European novel students, yes? Just because I sat like 10 minutes ago in a chemistry exam lecture theatre, in the old lecture theatre, and I have to get in with the new, right? So apologies for that, and I've set up a wee bit late. This lecture today is going to be on the novel in the city, and I guess it's going to pick up on things that Pablo has already lectured on in term one. So we're going to revisit some of those things, which is always good at the start of term. And we're going to push, using probably Dickens as a kind of lodestar text, into the text for this term. So we're going to think about the way that the city itself changes aesthetic modes, as much as aesthetic modes adapt to the structure and the space and the environment of the city itself. So, I mean, in a kind of like vulgar fashion, I guess, although, of course, we're always upsetting this, and it's important for you to remember that, we're going to think about the kind of transition between a more realist mode and a much more kind of hallucinatory modernist mode as we get from, say, Dickens to Dostoevsky and Pio Baroja, the Madrilenian novelist of the early 19th century, both of whom, Dickens and Baroja, are heavily influenced by Dickens himself. So it's probably quite important for us to think about that. So why the city then? Well, in form, in style, in subject matter, the city is absolutely crucial to the development of the modern novel, as it is modernization and modes of modernity. We're going to think then about the importance of urban setting and location on things like characterization, on plot, on form, style, and so on. And also in generating crucial themes in the 19th century novel, but also in the early 20s. Themes that kind of hang around and then are played around with as we move into the period from 1900 to, say, 1960, which is, of course, really the period that we're looking at almost in the second half of the term. I know that we've got Germinal to think about for next week, but we'll just park that for this moment in time. We're going to think about historical and spatial change, right, from a realist perspective to, as I've said, a modernist one, transformed by the time we get to the modernism of someone like Knut Hamsun, for example, or Fyodor Dostoevsky, but also supplemented by changes in artistic and philosophical outlooks. Now, we know all this happens, right? But what does the city do to affect these? That's the question that we want to kind of hang up in the air for the lecture. We're going to think about this using examples all the way through. And by the way, I'm going to give you through the term and duration of my lectures quite a lot of stuff that's already on the website. I think the slides I'm going to show you today are already up there. And for the next three or four lectures. I'm not going to refer to all of the material that's there. Some of the stuff in front of you today is purely for you to take away and read, right? Or do so, whatever you like with it. But it's just to say, we're not going to be covering the giant amount of text or the screeds of stuff that you'll be given in handouts. But we'll be pitching backwards and forwards between various wee bits. So we're going to think about the way that the city itself is determined in many respects, our cultural fate, and it still continues to do so, right, for the last 300 years or so. Urbanism is at the very heart of European and now, of course, world culture. One of the statistics that I like to trot out, when I give this lecture, is that in about 2006-2007, the United Nations put out a fact sheet saying that it was more or less confirmed that for the first time ever in human history, more people were now living in urban situations and settings than rural settings. That's quite an extraordinary thought, if you think about it, to haunt us. And we're going to come back to this kind of like latter-day explosion of rapid urbanization and think about how it sits with the world, especially of Dickens and Dostoevsky, which of course are kind of like fulcrums of rapid modern urbanization in the 19th and early 20th century. We're going to think about how, in some respects, as the last quote I'll give you today from the urban geographer Mike Davis, in some respects, we are going back in time with some situations about the development of urbanism to the 19th century in the 21st. And if that's confusing, well, fair enough. Right? That's why you're at university. No, I didn't mean that. I'll explain that along the way. So, the 19th century, as you know, right, is the century of great changes in social and physical landscapes, massive population shifts and drifts, and an enormous amount of rural to urban migration. of, you could say, urbanism as such. You know, this kind of thing that we've already seen in texts like Madame Bovary and Emma, where the city itself becomes this kind of like extraordinary location of desire and, of course, urbanity. The word is important. And again, in a kind of rather vulgar fashion, but it's quite good, quite handy to map. If we want to think about the 18th century English novel, say, as a novel which is largely rural in its outlook, but certainly, you know, kicks over the fence at the city, as a place of kind of like, you know, distance happenings, often a place of kind of like chaos and despair and moral turpitude, then we want to think about the 19th century as an increasing kind of like acceleration of those type of fears, mixed with a kind of like explosion of new opportunity that comes from the very space itself. And of course, you wouldn't get Dickens novels without that element of fear and fascination, right? It's the kind of common cliche when we think about the history and the development of the 19th century city. It revolutionizes the structure of experience, psychological and collective experience. It changes the very pattern of the self, forms of autonomy, ideas of freedom, ideas of political collectivism, and so on and so forth, because of the space and the ideas that circulate around and through it. Think of an example. Think of why you probably wouldn't get, this is arguable, but you might not get the plot of a novel like Crime and Punishment, for example, without the fact that anonymity and collective presence happens. Early on in the novel, remember, Raskolnikov, Roddy, right, is sitting in a tavern, and he hears his ideas, the ideas that he has been reading and circulating in various student pamphlets and anarchist manifestos, vocalized in a conversation between two other students and some officers in a pub, whom he doesn't know. And the figure of the anonymous stranger and the influence of the anonymous stranger, the sense of provisionality, as well as experience that itself projects, is also crucial for theme, but also for plot, right? Suddenly we're cast into a space where characterization itself just blossoms, and the opportunities for the modern novelist are quite extraordinary when we think about it. You've just got more people. So it's not uncommon, it's not coincidental that the development of a more kind of detective form of fiction also rises up at this time. I mean, you've got like boundless examples of possible, shall we say, victims, but also perpetrators, yeah? Of opportunities for the central protagonist as they drift through the city itself. Now, that can be an enormously enthralling mediated experience, but it can equally be one which fills a character with trepidation, and that balance between one and the other is kind of significant. So I want to think about all these themes will come backwards and forwards, and I'll keep trying to top them up as we go along, right? But let's get a quick, very bad poll. Who would say that they lived in the city? Okay, look all around you at your friend. The trouble with lecture theatres, everything seems to go this way, right? So stick your hands up and be bold. Who lives in the city? Who's from the city? Yeah, not bad. You just get away with it. Me too. I used to live somewhere. Who lives, they would say, in the country? Interesting. And who lives in between? Equally interesting, right? This kind of suburban belt, if you like, is really a kind of like a moment of the later 20th century. That becomes an interesting thing. It becomes much more of a kind of feature of, say, the postmodern novel, quote unquote, and a term I don't particularly like, but we'll deal with it. To deal with the kind of like the rapid development of suburbia. It's already happening to us to an extent in Dickens, but it's very much deregulated. I mean, one thinks of Dorrit's Journey in the Train, for example, into London for the first time, where it very quickly goes through a whole series of sort of half-built places, which I guess we might now call the beginnings of a suburban kind of element, into the developed city. But certainly in European spaces, because of various things to do with infrastructure, the demand for housing, and also the development of different energy systems, oil in particular, it's not really until the explosions, if you like, of the post-1930s, 1945 world that we really see suburbia develop the way we know it now, right, where we can all travel quite quickly and circuitously. And the clip I'm going to show you from David Lean, he goes to London in a stagecoach. So the question of the reachability of the city becomes crucially important. And that, of course, accelerates as the 19th century progresses and into the 20th. So Think about, say, the difference between a character like Emma Bovary, right, who struggles to kind of like, you know, the joke is she struggles to go out of the shrubbery. She's some, you know, her world is kind of impacted, and, you know, many critics see that as being a kind of like corollary of the 18th century novel itself, very much a static world that has to return back to more or less stable property relations, stable marriages, and so on. Everything is broken apart, of course, in Emma, but it's very quickly and necessarily bound back together again in the country house. Yeah? A character who's a kind of shady person, like, say, I don't know, what's his name, Frank Fairfax, he goes to London for a haircut, right? Because he's cool. So, all of you that put your hand up for various things, if you lived in the city, do you think you're cool? Nobody's going to admit to that, right? But we know the stereotype, right? City, cool. The very word urbane, think about it, right? Hipsters, that's the contemporary term, isn't it? See, we know these things, right? Hipsters. I wish I had my big glasses on and my wee thin trousers. And my wee tiny pointy shoes, but I don't. This comes from this sense of urbanity, right? We've been to the city. We know this. We've seen all these characters develop this, right? We've seen Madame Bovary, for example, pining for Paris, because of course it's everything that's not provincial, as the, you know, ridiculous fop Rodolphe would say. It's everything that isn't provincial. The city is where things happen, where you can be someone, right? A very powerful, desiring space, a space of happening, of opportunity, and of unstable, we might say, new developing circuits of modernity and possible social relations. Now, what a great feast for a novelist that is, right? Because, of course, the difference, the very easy difference is made with the country. And this is where Raymond Williams' great, you know, if you're going to do anything in this subject, you just have to read this book, right? The Country and the City is the classic, still, I guess, you know, very much relevant idea about this development of a division at first in the history of especially Western modernity and Western culture, a division between country and city, right? Now, Williams very carefully picks that apart and shows that there are different spaces that result in different types of cultural production, different novels as such, and that's kind of part of my argument. But he also says it's a wee bit more, it's not as simple as that might appear. His big idea is that the novel has to develop in accordance with this new space with a lot more people in it, right? Because there's a challenge for a novel, which is effectively and essentially, as he calls it, a knowable community. A knowable community. We get to know all the characters, if you like, in, say, Emma, quite quickly. You're right. But the figure of the stranger becomes a much more important thing. I mean, it's a classic plot device. And most country novels, one thinks of, for example, the greatest provincial novel that ever existed in England, right? And one from this very space, Middlemarch, George Eliot's Middlemarch, where the very figure of the kind of like, shall we say, you know, the surreptitious stranger appears in the figure of Bulstrode and commands a completely different identity for himself in the town, if you like, which is kind of like appended to the village, if you like, at that point. He comes from elsewhere. But that's just one example of one person. When we turn that around and we've cast the country figure into the city, suddenly the figure of the stranger takes enormous precedence, and plots change in accordance with that. Because quite frankly, a stranger is not knowable, right? Until you yourself indulge in that relationship. So Dickens's novels, of course, turn on that sense of knowability, right? There's a kind of sense of contingency and identity. There's also the sense of possibility that one can change one's identity and move through the various circuits that one finds there. But of course, being Dickens, the space itself is also a problem. I mean, Dickens is a great campaigner. We all know this. That's a great kind of figure, the great stereotype of Dickens' work, of his life, right? He campaigns for you know, a whole bunch of kind of like new, different social ameliorations in the city space itself, from you know, clean air to proper sewage, undergrounds, and so on and so forth. That's one of the great ideas and aspects of urban life. I mean, like, you know, there's a thing in The Guardian today of the tube being, what is it, 150 years old? You know, this great kind of like enormous new modern technology that erupts from the city itself. Modern hygiene comes from the necessity of the city, for example. Clean air acts come from the disastrousness of the kind of claustrophobic early city. But of course, in the middle of all that, the kind of configuration of the city as a space of illegality, a junk heap, if you like, a space of detritus, is also an enormously powerful trope. And we'll see that as we move in our trajectory from Dickens to Barocca. Anyway, let's just read a little bit of the Williams quote, and then we'll have a little tug on Great Expectations, and we'll look at a clip, and then we'll have a break, all right? And we'll get into modernism in the second half. I'm sorry, it's all very truncated. It's my own silly fault. So, Dickens says this. Sorry. I have to get used to that. William says this: all novels are in some sense noble communities. I'm going to jump here, right, but I want us just to hold on to this as we read the passages in the second half of the lecture. It's part of a traditional method, an underlying stance, an approach that the novelist offers to show people and their relationships, not sin, essentially knowable and communicable ways. The full extent of Dickens' genius can then only be realised when we see that for him in the experience of the city, so much that was important and even decisive could not simply be known or simply communicated, but had, as I have said, to be revealed, to be forced into consciousness. So we'll see that there's a kind of discoverable element that becomes important, and that's crucially important in becoming the driver of plots, right? It changes the plot itself. Of course, think about it. I mean, like a plot like Crime and Punishment, as you know, is a kind of detective novel in reverse, right? I mean, we know kind of why it happens. We know who did it. It's fairly straightforward for us. The real drama is in others finding out the anonymous person that did it, and in him eventually coming to terms with the environment and the pressures that surround him in order to divulge why he does it and so on, okay? Anyway, if we jump a little bit down to the middle of the paragraph, in the city kind of, we'll just carry on, it's probably easier that way. In the city kind, experience and community would be essentially opaque, and the country kind, essentially transparent. As a first way of thinking, there's some use in this contrast. There can be no doubt, for example, that identity and community become more problematic as a matter of perception and as a matter of valuation as the scale and complexity of the characteristic social organisation increased. Up to that point, the transition from city to country, from a predominantly rural to a predominantly urban society, is transforming and significant. The growth of towns and especially of cities in the metropolis, the increasing division and complexity of labour, the altered and critical relations between and within social classes, and changes like these, any assumption of a noble community, a whole community wholly knowable, became harder and harder to sustain. But this is not the whole story. And once again, in realizing the new fact of the city, we must be careful not to idealize the old and new facts of the country. For what is knowable is not only a function of objects, of what there is to be known, it's also a function of subjects, of observers, of what is desired and what needs to be known. And what you have then to see us throughout in the country writing is not only the reality of the rural community, it's the observer's position in and towards it, a position which is part of the community being known. So, of course, novels are enormously powerful in rendering this type of idea, right? Because they are constructed of important focalizers, which is why we keep probably battering that term into you, right? How crucially significant it is to think about perspective in terms of narration and in terms of protagonist position and space. Okay? Now, I'm not going to read all this out. This is just a by way of reminding you of the kind of position of the observer and the thoughts of the observer of Pip as he moves into London itself, right? Once he's about to receive his great expectations. And of course, these expectations, of course, can change, right? We know that they do. They have to change quite quickly as the novel moves into the city space. Why? Well, because as Williams himself says, the division of labour increases too. You can do not just one job or a fixed routine of jobs. If you don't like one thing, you can ditch it and maybe move to another one, right? You can become a writer or a butcher, if you like, in the city. You can't really do that from one position in the country. You're either someone who works in a shop, you're Trabs boy, or you're someone else. I'm not saying it's as easy and as simple and as demarcated as that, but that's the general idea. You can open yourself up to multiple experiences, might be the kind of like rather cliched way of putting it. But what does that mean then for the novelist, for the task of the novelist who has to kind of render this experience and possibility? Well, we'll see, right? This is him going into London itself, right? I've just picked out some quotes itself. I was scared by the immensity of London. It was all a smear with filth and flat and blood and foam. And then he sees an exceedingly dirty and partially drunk minister of justice. The great sooty dome of St. Paul's, you know, the edifice, if you like, of modern Christian moral organization is symbolically cloudy, right? It's difficult to pick out. It looms over everything else, as we see in a still from David Lean's movie, but it's somewhat problematic from the position of the observer, okay? The city itself is rather more cast in blood, filth, and foam. Ministers of justice are corrupt. We can see Dickens's whole moral vision in many respects in this one passage. But also in here is the notion of expectations, right? It's a space of opportunity that Pip himself has to deal with. And he has to confront the reality of the situation. And Jaggers, of course, the lawyer, corrupt, doing his job, is the ambivalent position to take in that respect. Now, think about this. I hope this works, right? This is the great disaster. This is the great David Lean film. Now, if I just touch this, is that, yes, it seems to work. This is the clip in the movie where, of course, ridiculously, young Pip, who is actually a young boy, changes into a wee bit older Pip, who's ridiculously old, right? So the kind of, like, grotesque transformation that he makes is very much rendered on screen. But he's moving here in the stagecoach to the city. Now, think about the position of observation in the cinematic rendition, right? And the figure of the stranger and the look on Pip's face, too, encapsulates pretty much this fear and fascination narrative. So, DVD. Okay. Now, think about what that leaves us with, that rendition, right? We have the question of where we're going to on the map. It's all kind of rather dizzying. The scene clips go much quicker. The edit is much quicker than the previous parts of the movie. The suggestion is, of course, that life is rapidly accelerating, that chance and possibility are going to become key factors in the new experience of the city itself, as well as opportunity, of course. And we can see it written, you know, it's written all over Pip's face, isn't it? I mean, it's clear that he's there. But also the sense of trepidation becomes crucial. The notion also of rapid movement, of bodily movement, of conversational discourse is also going to become increasingly apparent in this new experience. And I want to leave it, I want to just hang there for a minute, because this question of the kind of dynamic strings, I mean, we see the guy who's standing on the wall. The camera seems to pan to him very momentarily, as if to say he may be an important figure. But it's purely speculative, of course. He's important only in the sense that he's a random person who lives in the same space, occupies the same, but as we'll see, possibly a different space, in the new space that Pip has been thrust into. So this question of the kind of random, chance, contingent stranger, and the way that the cultural product has to deal with it, has to reorganize its aesthetic organization in order to think about how to render that space, becomes a challenge for the novelist after Dickens. Okay, let's just take a minute. In my lectures, I just like to stop, right, at sort of half past. Not completely stop. People are going, what? Some people are going, well, why doesn't he stop? For about a minute or so, just to stretch, to take a downtime, and then kind of like go back up again, right? It's rebooting. That's what it's called in the modern age, right? So let's just talk among yourselves, do what you like for 1 minute, and then we'll go back to it. So, that was a short one. I promise you a longer one, right? You can get up and exercise if you like in the middle of it all. That's absolutely up to you. No problem at all. We can do some calisthenics at the end of the lecture course. So, I wanted to read all of this quote, but I'm not going to get there, right? I'm just going to draw your attention to a couple of things, really, because I want to make an argument now about this idea of the city being a kind of entropic space, right, where energy itself can kind of like gradually dissipate and break up and fragment. And how it's always in the background, if you like, of the kind of like figures in the novel who are striving in some sort of respect to keep that destitution from the door. And we'll see this quite a lot, actually, happily, right, in the next two or three novels that you're going to look at. But we'll kind of park that for the moment. But this question of, this is Barnard's, this is just the scene just after the part in the movie that you watched. He looks at his accommodation. He's proposed accommodation in Barnard's Inn, right? Let's just get a flavour of some of the description. If you go halfway down, I thought the windows of the sets of chambers into which these houses were divided were in every stage of dilapidated blinding curtain, crippled flower pot, cracked glass, dusty decay, and miserable makeshift. While, and the repetition is important, right, to let, glared at me from empty rooms, as if no new wretches ever came there, and the vengeance of the soul of Barnard were being slowly appeased by the gradual suicide. So it's a kind of like deathly, unenergetic space, right? It's almost a dead space. It's a space that's disused as such, although it seems to be. But what I think is important is, in trying to get you to think about this notion of fleeting relations, the new world of fleeting relations, is this question of to let. The contingent world, a world which is of the rentable citizen, we might say. You can occupy a space in this city, and then if things work out for you, you can leave it. Of course, where the wretches go that cannot leave this space under the frouzy gravel of Barnard's Inn is also a question. So the city is very much a kind of challenge in many respects for Dickens. How does one rise out of this? Does one do it morally and legally, or does one append oneself to the new autonomy that the city itself brings forth, the new apparent types of freedom? I mean, think about someone like Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky's whole book's about the new autonomy that the city might actually give him. He sees a space, an intellectual space as much as a physical space, to make a challenge to society, right? It's a space like this, rented by someone who he sees as corrupt, that he has a problem with, right? So he offs her, which is problematic, right? Isn't it? No, it's not. No, I would have done it. That's what you're all saying. But, you know, the challenge is nonetheless there, right? We see some grain of reasonable actions in what Roger does. Of course, it's terrible that he... Anyway, those of you that are in my seminar group, it's tough because I'm going to face you with that philosophical challenge. But the important thing is that new ideas are circulating that force new perceptions on two characters. And of course the novelist has to deal with that and stretches these things out, but equally they're challenging. They're psychologically challenging. And this, of course, finds itself not only into literary fiction, but also into all manner of different artistic styles, as we'll see. So the urban world is one of upheaval, possibility, difference, new communities, and new relations, as much as one of estrangement, alienation, and isolation, right? All these things that we know about from MWL. And it's a crucial expression of the 19th century European novel and into the 20th. What the city does is it affords us fiction, and fiction is important here, of multiple connections. You can make up an identity for yourself if you wish. It's very exciting to do so, of course, but it also might be problematic. And it asks us to think about how these connections can be made. How does one get a job as a baker, for example, as Manuel does in La Buesca, right? I mean, how does that happen? This is partly what the novel is there to tell us. You apply for a job as a baker. But then how does one get a job as a dust heap boy? Well, you kind of just stumble upon someone because of the way that your fate and fortune works out, right? Very close to living in the cave, as we see in the whole of The Quest, which stands as a kind of Barnard's inn for that novel. So we have connections that can be made, but what impels and drives characters to meet other expectations, to transgress social and moral boundaries that are themselves in question because of the opportunity of the city? Boundaries that dissolve due to the rapid circulation and the broadcast of alternative ideas, such as in Crime and Punishment. Powerful new social notions that disseminate quickly in the city environment. But it also depends on the levels of development that are available at any particular time, and these work through unevenly across the various city spaces of London. Think, for example, of Madrid at the time of The Quest. A city which is fighting the very notion of imperial decline of Spain itself, having lost its colonies in Cuba and South America in the late 19th century, and is having to deal with a new identity and fighting the industrial cities of the Basque North and Catalonia, especially Barcelona, as a space of kind of like, a lack of new cultural energy, a lack of opportunity. And we see this kind of like fragmented space with, on one hand, the possibility of technological development, and on the other, a space that's chaotic. A space, if you like, that still cleaves to old class and aristocratic feudal definitions of what relationships and social relationships are supposed to be. And in a sense, Manuel has to deal with that as he just wanders like a vagrant through that space. This is, and you can see, of course, Dickens' influence on Barocca very clearly here, the same kind of experience of Manuel, the young boy, moving to the city, although he doesn't do it in a stagecoach, he does it in the new electric trains, yeah? Because electricity becomes a crucially important force that itself energetically drives a new set of social and industrial organizations that occupy any kind of European space from then on in. At different times, of course, right? By the time that you get to the atom station, which of course is about a different type of energy altogether, nuclear, we see a very minor concentration. Another novel about a young girl who goes from a naive young girl who goes from the provinces, from the country, from the very rural part of subsistence croft living, to the cool new centre of Reykjavik, that the first thing she thinks about is an electric vacuum cleaner that she uses as a servant girl in the house of the MP that she works in. Electric heating is on in the house that she goes to visit. She's astonished by this. It reminds her of the space from whence she came and of the new space and the new modernity of the world that's available to her in and by the city, which hasn't yet percolated out to the provinces. I mean, it will do so eventually, of course. But that's in 1945. So in a sense, these kind of like this uneven development is crucial. Anyway, when one of his traveling companions announced that they had reached Madrid, Manuel was filled with genuine anxiety. A red dusk flushed the sky, which was streaked with blood like some monster's eye. So again, we still have this kind of like gothic element of the grotesque, smear, blood-filled world of the kind of butchering city, right? As well as the kind of like hellish imagery that works its way through. The train gradually slackened speed. It glided through squalid suburbs and past wretched houses. By this time, the electric lights were gleaming pallidly above the high signal lanterns. It rolled on between long lines of coaches. The round tables trembled with an iron rumble. And the Estación de Mediodía, illuminated by arc lamps, came into view. So it's a big, new, bright world, right, of visual splendor in some respects that reminds us of a kind of like whole new world that Manuel is entering. He's never seen it before, anything like this, of course, in his life. From the bridge, the town seemed more fantastic and mysterious than ever. Upon a wall might be made out the galleries of a palace, and several lofty, somber towers shot up from amidst the jumbled dwellings of the town. A strip of moon gleamed close to the horizon, and the river, divided by a few islets into arms, glittered as if it were mercury. So the world of kind of like fantastic illumination, it seems almost unreal to Manuel, and it's configured almost in a kind of like fairy tale fashion, right? This is the position of the observer. He can't quite associate it with technological modernity, so the novel has to go back to a much more archaic way of looking at things, right? Like a kind of like a fairy tale almost, as such, an archaic literary form. And of course, we see these, it's not very rendered very well, we see these not just in literary fiction, of course, we see it as crucial to a whole explosion of artistic modernity. I mean, Impressionism loves the city, right? This is Pissarro's Montmartre and Louis, a very, very famous painting. Just put that down there, you'll see it a little bit better. The same sort of linguistic experience and description is tried to be aimed at here by the Impressionist artist, right? The fleeting, transitory nature of new electric visibility, but also of random shifting movement. And there are much more bodies and things and structures that are consistently moving. Yeah? We're used to this now, of course, but we think about the amount of scraps of discourse that you yourself see just on the way to this lecture theatre that are seeing right now. We process them much easier. But if one casts oneself back into someone who is not quite familiar with this space, we can see the utter shockwave that might appear on the retina as much as on the mind of the protagonist. And of course, in Impressionism, it tries to render this. We see the nighttime hallucination of illumination, I should say, in so many different works that we're now familiar with. This is, of course, what might happen to you in the city if you don't get on, right? These, of course, are, I guess, the very famous black paintings of Francisco de Goya, the most important Spanish painter, and probably still the most important Spanish painter, although it's arguable. A huge influence, of course, on most Spanish artists. I mean, this is a kind of like early 1820s, 1840s painting, a whole series of black paintings. When he goes off his head, literally, he goes mad as such, and he paints a whole series of paintings of, if you like, the dispossessed. And this is a famous one. I only put it up there so you can think about that when you're reading about the people who exist in the caves in the city, right? Part of the city itself, but somehow external to it. It's the space that Manuel finds himself in at one point, and he has to move himself back out of that setting. So the question of this experience being the despair of kind of like urban crowd becomes an important feature to think through. Now, this is a long quote, I'm not going to read it all, but again, I'm doing it in a comparative fashion to think about the very experience, the claustrophobic new experience that the city itself presents and pushes shoves into the consciousness of characters. This is a very famous scene. Again, it takes place on a bridge, right, as the Buesca scene did. Sorry, I keep saying La Buesca, The Quest, right? Again, full of interest in the way that the individual character is psychologically distressed and is somehow almost dealing with the idea of a beautiful new space that is also equally and at the same time chaotic, problematic. So, Raskolnikov went straight to Voznesensky Bridge, and he's always standing in bridges in Crime and Punishment, between two spaces, between two worlds, between two distinct possibilities. The physical world metaphorizes into the very themes that Dostoevsky is trying to push in respect to the transition of Russian life, especially in Petersburg, the kind of like more or less lodestar city of that transition. After parting with Razumikin, he felt so dreadfully weak that he had just managed to get to this place. He wished he could sit or lie down somewhere in the street, bending over the water of the canal. He watched mechanically the last pink reflections of the sunset. So again, we see the same sort of like preoccupation with a kind of hallucinatory vision that appears to be not quite real, but somehow real. And it's very painterly, if you like, in the Impressionist sense. The row of houses getting darker and darker in the gathering dusk, an attic window on the left bank blazing as though on fire in the last rays of the sun, which lit up for an instant, and the darkening water of the canal in which his whole attention seemed to be more and more concentrated. At length, red circles began whirling before his eyes, the houses seemed to move, the passers-by, the keys, the carriages, everything began to dance and rotate before his eyes. So we can see this kind of like elongated syntax, right? The kind of much more kind of looser frame of the sentence itself, trying somehow to deal with this multiple series of different visions in front of the character's face. And of course, we know that there's an enormous moral decision that's pressing down on him too by virtue of the plot. And then suddenly he gave a start, a hugely important word that, right in the center of the paragraph, right? Suddenly he gave a start and was perhaps saved from fainting again by a strange and horrible sight. He became aware that someone was standing close beside him on his right. He looked up and saw a tall woman with a shawl on her head and a long, yellow, haggard face and red, hollow eyes. She looked straight at him, but she quite obviously saw nothing, nor did she seem to be aware of the presence of anyone. Suddenly, she put her hand right, so this complete, this classic figure of alienation, right? She put her hand right on the parapet, lifted first her right, and then her left leg over the railing and threw herself into the canal. The dirty water parted, swallowed up its victim for a moment, but in another instant, the drowning woman came up again and floated gently down with the current face downwards, her head and legs in the water, and her skirt gathered up and puffed out like a pillow. A woman's drowned herself! A woman's drowned herself! Dozens of voices shouted. People came running from all over the place. Both sides of the canal were thronged with onlookers. A whole crowd of people gathered round Raskolnikov, pressing him against the railing. So this question of the very movement of city migration itself all appearing in one particular claustrophobic space is so resonant throughout Crime and Punishment, as it is in most Petersburg novels of this time. Because, of course, in about 1860, before the emancipation of the serfs, right, 84 million Russians live in the countryside. 5% of them live in the city. This changes very quickly within the space of like 4 or 5 years. Think about that. There's an enormous rush of citizens into, well, to become citizens, right, to be part of the city. And in many ways, the infrastructure can't quite deal with it. Now, of course, the crowd then becomes a subsequent challenge for any artist to deal with. It becomes a brilliant, as I said at the beginning of the lecture, a fantastic potential for novelistic plotting and characterization. But it also becomes a challenge to deal with, as to render in narrative, right? Even in description. So we see at the level of the sentence and the paragraph a change in psychological rendition in accordance with the kind of like change of the experience of the city itself. Always, of course, arguable, which is, of course, the very epicenter of literary study, right? But here also I want to just dwell on one thing before I show you some other cousin paragraphs to this. The question of the sudden event is dealt with quite quickly. I mean, the woman kills herself. So you're standing in the line, so you're standing at the bus stop waiting for the number 12, and someone jumps off the top of the number 12 bus or whatever it might be, or, you know, offs himself next. I mean, it's not a pleasant event, obviously. It's a sudden one. It happens quickly. But it's rendered almost psychologically, in a pre-psychologically disturbed state, right? Because we see already that Raskolnikov is very difficult, having a very difficult time himself. We don't know if things are quite real or not. We don't know if this actually happens or if he himself hallucinates it. It does happen, of course. And that's the very element of realism that Dostoevsky himself wants to chase. Fantastic realism, it's been called by Donald Fanger. Romantic realism, in many respects, moving from the kind of comedic romantic realism of Dickens. This notion that the reality that is out there is now new and different, but it's still real. It might be hallucinatory and odd and marvelous and crazy and visually incredible, but it still happens. The pressure of living in the city means that people throw themselves off canal bridges quite, not suddenly, but probably as a normal feature of life. I mean, one almost conditions oneself to the fact of suicide as such, or death, or accidents, on a much more, I mean, one becomes quickly accustomed to it, right? Not quite so here, because of course the experience of the crowd in the city and the kind of like new deleterious environment is just pressing itself into Dostoevsky himself, into Sawyer Raskolnikov himself. And of course that's why he does what he does, right? He's so desperate. He can't bear the fact that exploitation is happening in this space. So the random event becomes crucial. And it becomes crucial to as an experience itself in modernism generally. And of course, by the time you get to a novel like Hunger, where we have an actual artist or someone who's a wannabe artist, I want to be intellectual. Having to deal with the question of the strange city and all that that offers up to him in a very despairing psychological state, then we see how that is at the core of the whole novel itself. I'm not going to read the list out. Just familiarize yourself with these bits that I've put in black. He says he's estranged from myself. He's almost two people, right? Completely at the mercy of invisible influences. And then he also uses the new space with all of the new subjects and structures that are in front of him to his advantage. It accentuates his perception. Everything is now a possible subject. Now think about this in terms of reading. That suddenly destabilizes the event, right? So as he sees in the second paragraph here, nothing escaped my attention. I was lucid and self-possessed, and everything rushed upon me with a brilliant distinctness. Now, we know that that might be the case, but we also know that he's a crazy hunger artist, so we don't really trust him as readers as such. We have a contingent sense ourselves, right, of the novelistic rendition of the intellectual in this random space. The stranger, if you like, is the intellectual main character himself. I began to observe the people, he says. I laid myself open to every trifle. It's a very kind of like Dandy-esque thing to do, where, you know, the figure of the 19th century flaneur who walks around the city enjoying everything new and novel that's available to him or her. But here, everything is good until he sees a woman with a single tooth in front of her mouth. Nervous and susceptible as I had become during the last few days, the woman's face made a repellent impression on me right off. That long yellow tooth looked like a little finger sticking up from her jaw, and her eyes were still full of sausage as she turned towards me. Her eyes were still full of sausage? What kind of translation is that? Or is it simple? I mean, remember, surrealism is also crucial, right, to this kind of like whole new possibility of aesthetic rendition of the city. I lost my appetite instantly, of course you would, and felt nauseated. I want you to think about that wee eye full of sausage, right, as you experience your lunch today. But this is a problem, right? And he says at the bottom, I went with the flow born from place to place, this happy morning, rocking serenely. He changes every sentence. And he deals with life by what it puts in front of him. Now, that's problematic as much as it's liberating for the modern artist, right, who has to deal with a much quicker, pacier environment with a much more kind of like alienated sense of experience inside it. And of course, we know that this other kind of classic Norwegian rendition of that might be something like that, this problematic hallucinatory world of the city, much, I don't know, like, much parodied, of course, right? And by the time we get to, say, 1922, right, we have this classic, I mean, this is the last thing I'm going to read out. I'm just going to leave you with this to give you an indication of how Joyce, the classic novel of the city, right, One Day in Dublin, rendered through a whole series of different characters. The novel, of course, that you used to read in a European novel, but not anymore, but everyone should read, of course. And here we have Leopold Bloom, the main character, one of the main characters in Ulysses, standing on the street. Now, think about the way that if we have a kind of like more or less settled set of sentences that gradually pick themselves apart and, you know, where the plot in some respects caves in on itself, in a novel like Hunger, in Joyce, it's impacting even further. It's having to deal with the kind of jerry-built environment that surrounds Bloom. We see his external environment impact on the internal rendition of that in relation also to where he is as a person at that moment in time. So trams pass one another, ingoing, outgoing, clanging, useless words. Things go on same, day after day. Squads of police marching out, back, trams in, out. Those two loonies mooching about. So he's just basically looking around himself on the street here, and we can feel the kind of pan of the camera as he moves around, and the words have to somehow render that that random movement, right? Dignam carted off, and he goes backwards and forwards between his thoughts and the outside world. Mina Purefoy, swollen belly on a bed, groaning to have a child tugged out of her, one born every second somewhere, other dying every second. Since I fed the birds 5 minutes, 300 kicked the bucket. Other 300 born, washing the blood off, all are washed in the blood of the lamb, bawling, "Meh!" Cityful passing away, other cityful coming, passing away too. Other cityful coming on, passing on. Houses, lines of houses, streets, miles of pavements, piled up bricks, stones, changing hands, this owner, that, to let, to let, to let. Remember that? Landlord never dies, they say. Other steps into his shoes when he gets his notice to quit. Some landlords die violently, of course. They buy the place up with gold, and still they have all the gold, swindling it somewhere. Bit of racism, no question. Piled up in cities, worn away age after age. Pyramids in sand, built on bread and onions. Slaves, Chinese wall, Babylon, big stones left, round towers, rest rubble, sprawling suburbs, jerry-built. Just like the prose, just like what he's trying to get across. Kirwan's mushroom houses, built of breeze, shelter for the night. No one is anything. This is the very worst hour of the day. Vitality, dull, gloomy. Hate this hour. Feel as if I'd been eaten and spewed. Hopefully you won't feel eaten and spewed, right? Time for your lunch. We'll come back to this at some point next week, all right?